The players take a knee, repeal and replace takes a hit, and Big Luther takes it on the chin. All on the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. President Trump says his criticism of NFL players was about the flag, but he may have created an entire league of Colin Kaepernicks.
In NFL locker rooms, they do have this thing they call the brotherhood. Very much like a Spartacus, injury to one is an injury to all kind of a thing. And so when you have the President of the United States calling upon people to be fired, that was something that inflamed NFL players.
Plus, the more right-wing Senate candidate won in Alabama, but does that really give the Democrats a shot at taking the seat?
Doug Jones basically has to run a perfect race from now until December 12th to have a shot at beating Roy Moore. But the Democrats I've met down here seem pretty enthusiastic about Jones. Whether there's enough of them to take him over the top remains to be seen.
And we go back nearly a half century to a Hubert Humphrey campaign speech that almost turned around an election.
As president, I would stop the bombing of the North as an acceptable risk for peace, because I believe it could lead to success in the negotiations and thereby shorten the war.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 198 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. There were a few eye-rolling stories of the past week that caught our attention. The news that presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner used a private email account to conduct White House business has to be among the most delicious, especially because you know how some feel about private email servers.
Is she going to be brought before Congress or something? Is something going to happen? Is something going to happen? Because it's a disgrace. Hillary Clinton claimed that the reason for her illegal use of a private insecure email, right? She claimed this was that it was more convenient to use just one device. Oh, these are all lies. We say lie, 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 lie. Dirty, rotten liar, right?
Less delicious and certainly more alarming, the back and forth between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un continues. Pyongyang says Trump's talk about destroying North Korea was a declaration of war, giving his country the right to shoot down U.S. planes, even if they're flying over international airspace. Is American diplomacy an option? Not sure we heard that from the president on Tuesday.
We are totally prepared for the second option, not a preferred option. But if we take that option, it will be devastating, I can tell you that, devastating for North Korea. That's called the military option. If we have to take it, we will.
But the big story of the week is the failure, the latest failure, of the Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. Stopped in July when three GOP senators voted no, the effort surprisingly resurfaced a week or so ago when Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy offered up a new version. Like July's so-called skinny bill, the Graham-Cassidy bill would also have halted Medicaid funding and, according to the CBO, cut the number of people insured by millions. Unlike the earlier bill, it would have given individual states block grants to spend on health insurance as they saw fit. Time was not on their side. A budget reconciliation provision stated that for the bill to pass with just 50 votes, it had to come up for a vote before September 30th, the end of the fiscal year. After that, it would need 60 votes to pass. The problem? It didn't even have 50. Rand Paul said he would vote no because it wasn't conservative enough. John McCain and Susan Collins said they would vote no for the same reasons they voted no in July. And with others possibly joining them, Lisa Murkowski's name was most mentioned, Republican leaders knew it was a lost cause. They announced on Tuesday the bill would be withdrawn from the consideration, not even bringing it up for a vote. Here's Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, bent but not broken.
We haven't given up on changing the American health care system. We are not going to be able to do that this week, but it still lies ahead of us, and we haven't given up on that.
McConnell did not have the best of weeks. His candidate for the Senate in Alabama, Luther Strange, was defeated in Tuesday's primary, and one of his top allies in the Senate, Bob Corker of Tennessee, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, announced on Tuesday that he would not seek a third term. Corker had been the target of a series of Trump tweets, and some of the president's allies were plotting a primary challenge against him next year. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last Republican senator from a southern state to retire and watch his seat get picked up by the Democrats? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you.
The location was Huntsville, Alabama. A rally last Friday night for Luther Strange, the appointed Republican incumbent senator, who is in a tough primary runoff to fill the final 3 years of a vacancy. Donald Trump, the president of the United States and the guest of honor who supported Strange, suddenly changed subjects. He starts talking about, well, we all respect the flag, and then, with no warning, came this.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
He then went into how referees are ruining the game by calling all those penalties. The players should be able to hit each other, Trump said, without the refs interfering in the action. And then he went on.
You know what's hurting the game more than that? When people like yourselves turn on television and you see those people taking the knee when they're playing our great national anthem. The only thing you could do better is if you see it, even if it's one player, leave the stadium. I guarantee things will stop. Things will stop. Just pick up and leave. Pick up and leave.
And guess what that led to? On Sunday, NFL players all over the country either sat or kneeled or stayed in the locker room during the playing of the national anthem. Even some team owners, who have been Trump contributors and supporters, locked arms with their players. Of course, the infusion of politics into sports is not a new phenomenon, but it's hard to recall any president who behaved like this. Dave Zirin is a sports columnist for The Nation magazine. He blogs at edgeofsports.com, and he's the author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Dave, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think we both agree that this is not the first time we've seen politics play a role in sports.
No, politics has been part of organized sports in this country as long as there's been organized sports in this country. Sometimes when I speak to a young classroom of people, like in high school or college class, I ask them, guess who was the first president to invite a pro sports team to the White House? And students usually guess someone like John Kennedy or Theodore Roosevelt. Some even go as far as Ronald Reagan. And I tell them, no, it was Johnson, not Lyndon Johnson, Andrew Johnson. It goes back to one of the first professional baseball teams was invited to the White House by Andrew Johnson for a media op as a way to show that the country was coming together after the Civil War. So the use of sports for political ends truly is as old as organized sports itself.
And of course, when you think of the more modern times, you know, there was the stripping of Muhammad Ali's heavyweight title. There was a demonstration at the Mexico City Olympics in 68 by Tommy Smith and John Carlos. So we've seen that for the last 50 years pretty regularly.
Yeah. And I mean, it goes back before that. Certainly. I mean, if you're talking about like sports is actually a platform for resistance, you can go back to Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion, as well as the efforts of women to try to play sports when it was just simply denied to them at the end of the 19th century. And I think it makes sense why sports has always been the site of political tumult, because we use sports to tell a story about the United States, that this is a meritocracy and the best are able to make it, you know, regardless of class or birth. And sports is the representative of that. Yet in the real world, the playing field is anything but level. And so sports becomes this incredible stage where people of color, LGBT people, women have to fight for access and fight for space and fight for this country to live up to its ideals. And that in and of itself always creates a political firestorm at the heart of sports.
Well, when I was preparing for my interview with you, I read something that I didn't even know before, that in 1936, when Jesse Owens competed in that, you know, the Berlin Olympics and won the 3 gold medals, you know, in the face of Hitler and all that, he came back to the U.S. and saw that only white athletes were invited to meet President Roosevelt at the White House. All the African-American athletes, I guess there were 7, 8, or 9 of them, whatever, they were not invited because FDR was seeking re-election that year and he didn't want to jeopardize his chances, even though he went on to win an unbelievable landslide.
Yeah, and the famous line from Jesse Owens was, Adolf Hitler didn't snub me, Franklin Roosevelt snubbed me. Because there's this story about, and it's apocryphal?
Apocryphal?
Yeah, that Adolf Hitler was supposed to shake Jesse Owens' hand and refuse. The actual story is that Adolf Hitler didn't even stay for the race. So in a way, Adolf Hitler, of course, did snub Jesse Owens, but this idea that famous line that FDR snubbed me, not Adolf Hitler, was something that Jesse Owens said for decades after 1936.
Right. It's one thing to be snubbed in Germany. It's another thing to come back to your own country and be snubbed by your own president. So let me go back to last Friday when Trump gave that son of a bitch speech in Alabama. Who besides Colin Kaepernick was taking a knee during the national anthem?
Well, a lot of players, certainly not to what we've seen, but you know, other than an instance, if you take away when the Cleveland Browns had about a dozen players all take a knee, it was about 9 players. And so these were the players who were keeping the embers of Colin Kaepernick's act of resistance alive into the 2017 season. And their reasons for doing so were the same as Colin Kaepernick's. It was an anti-racist gesture. It was a gesture against police brutality. I know players like Chris Long and Michael Bennett were also very much inflamed by what had taken place in Charlottesville and the fact that people marched with swastikas, and Donald Trump said that very fine people were marching in that event. And so all of this, I think, is really important because Colin Kaepernick lit the match, and those embers were still alive going into this season. And then there's Donald Trump in Huntsville, and Donald Trump has this lizard brain that's attuned to the worst, most divisive, most bigoted instincts of his audience. And so I'm sure Donald Trump's lizard brain said, I can demonize these 9 players, and they are black millionaires, and they're protesting racism, and this is a great sort of populist issue to use patriotism as a fig leaf for racism and go after them. But Donald Trump never played the game of football, and so he doesn't understand that in NFL locker rooms, they do have this thing they call the brotherhood. And the thing about the brotherhood is that it's very much kind of like a Spartacus, injury to one is an injury to all kind of a thing. And so when you have Donald Trump use that phrase SOB, when you have Donald Trump saying the things that he said about players should be fired from their job, the president of the United States calling upon people to be fired for exercising their free speech rights, that was something that inflamed NFL players. And let's not give short shrift to the SOB comment either. Because for a lot of players, they saw that as an attack on the mothers of these NFL players. Not only is it horrifically misogynistic, not only is it the sort of thing that anybody knows from the time they're schoolyard age, that you don't talk about people's mothers, but the mother in the National Football League actually has a kind of esteemed and special place in the locker room as somebody who is part of the family of the NFL. And so as soon as Donald Trump said SOB on Friday night, I knew that my next 72 hours were going to be subsumed by this. And I wasn't wrong.
didn't Trump create dozens of more Kaepernicks around the NFL?
Well, yes and no, because he did. But it also, I think, has served to obscure the message that Colin Kaepernick and other people like Michael Bennett have been trying to express from the beginning. So this is, I think, morphed in the last several days from a very specific and very direct message about racism and police brutality into something that's sort of much broader and, you know, much more confused. I mean, it's like it's an anti-Trump thing. It's a First Amendment thing. It's almost like just yet another polarizing issue in this country with Trump on one side and these NFL owners and players on the other. And yet what's lost in all of this, I think, is that original message, which is people are being killed in the United States and not receiving justice because the people who are killing them are wearing blue. And I think that question of how we do policing in the United States, which these players were using their platform to raise, has become obscured.
Some have noticed, and maybe you may agree, but some have pointed out that it seemed like Trump found it much harder to criticize white supremacists than he did with American athletes.
And, you know, that's a statement that I made. That's a statement that Hillary Clinton said. And that's also a statement that Alex Smith, the quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs, said. Several NBA players said that. I mean, it's just so glaring. And so when people like Jemele Hill of ESPN, she got in so much trouble for calling Trump a white supremacist. This is the kind of evidence, and I've said the same, that we're putting on the table. I mean, when you're angrier at dissenting black athletes and you're willing to destroy and demonize these players and call for them to be fired, when that is a greater concern to you than people marching with swastikas, I mean, I think that sort of gives the game away as far as who Donald Trump is and the kind of and the way he speaks to the worst angels of people's natures. I mean, I'm here talking to you in Washington, D.C. As we're having this conversation last night, they opened a new Institute for Race Studies at American University. And after they had this town meeting to talk about what this would comprise, they go out and they see that 10 Confederate flags had been posted up with cotton balls posted underneath them. I mean, this is an unbelievable thing that's happening in this country. And not only is Donald Trump, in my opinion, responsible for giving confidence to just the worst people in this country, he also takes no accountability for it, which makes it all the more destructive.
And one thing we haven't mentioned, we've been focusing on the NFL, but we saw what happened with Donald Trump and the Stephen Curry invitation that was rescinded and the reaction from LeBron James. So this transcends sports, doesn't it?
Oh, it certainly does. And also the WNBA players as well did their own anthem protest during the finals. It's just, I mean, we all know how hegemonic the National Football League is on our sports and cultural landscape. So it has taken up a lot of the oxygen. But at the same time, it's worth keeping in mind that LeBron James has twice as many Twitter followers as Donald Trump. So when LeBron James calls Donald Trump a bum and says, "You bum," and which is just and says it was an honor to go to the White House, you were in it. I mean, my goodness. I mean, I think that was a shattering moment for Donald Trump.
You know, I've seen it written that that people who don't like politics somehow find solace in sports. But, you know, as this conversation has proven, politics has always been part of sports. And I guess it'll probably increase, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think sports and politics, as you said, have always been one and the same. And they've always walked hand in hand. I think when people say sports and politics don't mix, what they're really saying is that sports and resistance politics don't mix. And this idea of using sports as a platform to push back against the prevailing politics of this country. I know you love history, Ken. So one of the stories that I love recalling is that, you know, when Jackie Robinson started to speak out as part of the civil rights movement in the late 50s after he retired, he was totally criticized and told sports and politics don't mix. You have no place going on these marches with Dr. King. And yet in 1949, when he was asked testify in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee and condemn Paul Robeson, nobody at that time was saying to him sports and politics don't mix, because he was echoing the prevailing politics of his boss and of the mainstream media. So it's always about the kind of politics, not politics in and of itself.
Dave Zirin is a sports columnist for The Nation magazine, a blogger at edgeofsports.com, and the author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Dave, it was great having you on the show.
No. It's an honor for me, Ken. Thank you for your work.
Hey, pretty baby.
You can't sit up.
Don't you hear the drummer thumping?
You can't sit up.
You gotta shake it like a crazy.
You can't sit up.
Cause the band is saying something.
You can't sit up.
Everybody is a jumping.
You can't sit up.
You gotta slap out.
Crazy sound. No, you can't sit down. No, you can't sit down.
The candidate President Trump campaigned for in Alabama, Senator Luther Strange, was defeated in the primary runoff on Tuesday. He had solid backing from the forces of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the GOP establishment, and he had plenty of money. Still, he lost by 10 percentage points to Roy Moore, the controversial twice-deposed Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. In his victory speech, Moore showed no hard feelings toward those who had opposed him.
Together we can make America great. We can support the president. Don't let anybody in the press think that because he supported my opponent that I do not support him and support his agenda. As long as it's constitutional, as long as it advances our society, our culture, our country, I will be supportive as long as it's constitutional. But we have to return the knowledge of God and the Constitution of the United States to the United States Congress.
Brian Lyman is a state government reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser and joins us. Brian, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, I mean, Roy Moore had the lead from the moment he finished first in last month's primary, and he basically never gave it up. The polls said he would win, and he did. So maybe the results were not a surprise, but it was an interesting result.
Yeah, with all the money that was spent on Senator Luther Strange's behalf, I think a number of people, including myself, thought it might be closer than what we saw. But, you know, Moore has a dedicated base of followers who will come out for him no matter what the circumstance. I mean, if Donald Trump was the president, if Hillary Clinton was the president, I mean, if we had had a special election, those voters would still be coming out for him and supporting him. I mean, I think what you're seeing here is just an enthusiasm being far more valuable than money in Alabama politics.
But I remember when he ran a few years ago, when Roy Moore ran for governor in the Republican primary, he finished fourth. Why did he suddenly seem so unbeatable now and so definitely beatable years ago? Or have politics changed with Trump in the White House?
We're coming off just a enervating series of scandals that have enveloped Alabama state government. You know, we had the governor resigned in April. The House Speaker was convicted of ethics violations last year. And Alabamians generally tend to be cynical about their state government, often with good reason. More to a lot of his followers, they tend to think of Alabama politicians as people who just get into office and then just serve themselves. Moore's followers tend to see him as somebody who was elected to office, refused to compromise his principles, and suffered for it.
And you mentioned the embattled governor. This embattled governor is the one who appointed Luther Strange to the Senate.
That's right. And, you know, Strange never really had a natural constituency in Alabama. He was kind of one consultant. I don't think they meant this as a pun, but, you know, one consultant called Strange a stranger in Alabama. For a guy who was in high office, he just never really had a strong, solid identity.
Did Trump's visit, his endorsement, did it help or hurt Luther Strange, or did it make a difference at all?
It looked pretty neutral. You know, before the primary, there were some polls that, you know, asked people after Trump tweeted his endorsement of Luther Strange. There were polls out that said, well, yeah, did this affect your vote? And the majority of Republicans said no. There was a poll conducted by Signal, a Montgomery-based firm, I want to say like over the weekend after Trump visited. Again, and that thing found the same result. I mean, I think it was like 52-53% of Republicans said it had no impact on their decision. I spoke with Republicans Tuesday. They said it had no impact on their decision. I mean, a lot of them, you know, they were pretty much voting because they like Roy Moore or they don't like Roy Moore. Trump was kind of like a sideshow to them.
Well, at last Friday's rally in Huntsville, it sounded like Trump was hedging his bet.
And you know what? And I told Luther, I have to say this, if his opponent wins, I'm going to be here campaigning like hell for him. But I have to say this, and you understand this, and just look at the polls, Luther will definitely win. No? You know what I'm saying. Roy has a very good chance of not winning in the general election. No, it's all about the general. Don't forget, we don't stop here. You have an election coming up the day this is over. So this is over on Tuesday. On Wednesday morning, the new race begins. You got to beat a Democrat. Luther's going to win easily, and Roy's going to have a hard time winning. But I will be backing him if he wins. I will be backing him. Okay? I'll tell you that.
Brian, it almost sounded like Trump was ready for Moore's victory.
That's what it sounds like to me. Moore is going to go into this general election the heavy favorite against the Democratic nominee, Doug Jones. But Moore has some significant vulnerabilities that I don't think anybody on either a Democrat or a Republican should overlook. For one thing, he usually doesn't do a good job raising money. It's typically because he doesn't need it, but in general elections, that can hurt him. In 2006, he challenged then-Alabama Governor Bob Riley, led some early polls, but Riley had a good economy, handled some disasters well, and they just raised a ton of money, ignored Roy, just ran a fairly upbeat message and easily beat him in the Republican primary that year. In 2012, Democrat Bob Vance, who's a judge up in Jefferson County, he challenged Moore in the Chief Justice race. Vance had a late start and started with no money, but he raised a ton of it, managed to peel off some Republicans who would, they're really more considered like business Republicans, came within like 4 points of beating Moore in a year where Mitt Romney carried Alabama by about 23 points. So I want to stress, though, that, Moore is going to be the favorite going into December. But, there is a history of Moore badly underperforming, when it comes to general elections, and it's something both parties should consider going forward.
Well, you mentioned the December 12th general election, and as Donald Trump said, he thought that Luther Strange had a much better chance against the Democrat Doug Jones than Roy Moore does. But tell me a little bit about Doug Jones.
Jones is a former U.S. attorney in Birmingham. His major claim to fame is that during his time as U.S. attorney, he helped prosecute and convict two of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombers who killed four little girls in Birmingham in 1963. Jones considered a run against Jeff Sessions back in 2002, but he ultimately decided not to really get into the race. Otherwise, though, he's a newcomer. He's well known in Democratic circles. He still needs to introduce himself to the state as a whole. But he fits a pretty mainstream Democratic profile. He wants to uphold the Affordable Care Act. He's talked a little bit about support for a public option. He's talked about raising the minimum wage. He fits into basically the mainstream of Democratic politics. And he's probably about the strongest candidate the Democrats can put up right now. So he basically has to run a perfect race from now until December 12th to have a shot at beating Roy Moore. But, I can say nationwide, we've seen Democrats, doing well in most special elections. The Democrats I've met down here seem pretty enthusiastic about Jones. Whether there's enough of them to take him over the top remains to be seen.
I was going to say, this kind of reminds me of that House race we saw back in Georgia a few months back that everybody was focused on it. Ultimately, the Democrats lost it when a lot of Democrats thought they would win it. But in mid-December, this Senate race in Alabama is going to be the only game in town.
Yeah, and we're seeing some national Democrats get interested in the race, like former Vice President Joe Biden is supposed to be campaigning for Jones on October 3rd. There's some fundraising going on by the national Democratic organizations. Jones is going to be the underdog in this no matter what, but there are paths. They could be vertical paths, but there are paths to beating Roy Moore that have been shown by both Democrats and Republicans. If there's no other show in town, then the Democrats could do worse than spending some money here. If nothing else, if Jones can run a good race, he might create some infrastructure that could really help Alabama Democrats in the state elections in 2018.
I just wonder, though, that running with national Democratic support in Alabama, I just wonder how that might play.
That would play very badly, and I'm sure that we'll see ads trying to tie Jones to Nancy Pelosi or to Chuck Schumer or whatnot. If what Democrats or the Jones campaign wants to do to win in Alabama is just basically run a very upbeat campaign, because Moore doesn't necessarily run upbeat campaigns. If Jones just talks about Alabama issues, just tries to, put up a positive message, tries to, very carefully target groups that will vote against Roy Moore, that, there are people in Alabama who can be convinced to come out to vote against the former Chief Justice, he might have a shot.
But the fact that Roy Moore has been endorsed by God, that has to help in Alabama.
Yeah, but, you know, all the politicians in Alabama have been endorsed by God, so, you know, everybody can sort that out.
Brian Lyman is covering the Alabama Senate race for the Montgomery Advertiser. Brian, it was great having you on the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Crying, God knows I'm good. God knows I'm good. God knows I'm good. Surely God won't look the other way. God knows I'm good. God knows I'm good. God knows I'm good. Surely God won't look the other way.
A few weeks ago, we had a guest on the program who talked about Hillary Clinton's new book, What Happened, that chronicled her surprising loss to Donald Trump in last year's election. Given that the book was written by someone who expected to become the 45th president, and given that there was no shortage of people she claimed cost her the election, it was not a happy tome. Another book that just came out, also from a Democratic perspective, had a much different feel to it. Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years is by David Litt, a speechwriter for the 44th president. Given that Barack Obama served two terms and left office with high approval ratings, one might think that this book had a lighter, happier feel to it than Clinton's, and it does. It chronicles Litt's rise from a young campaign aide to one of his top speechwriters, and it is filled with fun stories, hilarious moments. It reminds Democrats of what it was like to have one of them in the White House. David Litt is on the phone now from Los Angeles and joins the program. David, it's great having you on the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And one thing that I found so enjoyable about the book is that it is unexpectedly funny. Now, the reason I say that is because, I mean, every speechwriter has his or her amusing moments, amusing anecdotes, and I was expecting that kind of book, but this was different. It's as if you were taking us on a wacky journey with you.
Well, I like that, a wacky journey. I think in some ways maybe it was that kind of journey, and I wanted to write a White House book that acknowledges that I was not in the inner circle of the White House. I was 24 years old when I started, so I got to write about all of the feelings that you have when you're young and starting out in one of your first jobs, and you're terrified of your boss's boss, except my boss's boss was the President of the United States, so... You know, when I was intimidated in that office, it happened to be the Oval Office. And I'm glad that you and others are responding to it.
Well, you know, you wrote not only speeches, but you wrote comedy bits as well, like for the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Usually a president has one person for the speeches and one person for the jokes. Did you get paid double?
I wish. No, I would spend about 11 months of the year doing exactly what all of my other colleagues in the speechwriting office did, working on policy addresses, videotapings, whatever. And then about 1 month a year, as the Correspondents' Dinner began to really ramp up, I would switch over and I would do jokes. But because of my job, sometimes there was some overlap. So, for example, in 2014, I was working on the Correspondents' Dinner jokes. And at the same time, I was also working on a speech about Holocaust remembrance that the president was going to deliver the week after the Correspondents' Dinner. So it was a very strange experience spending, you know, my morning dealing with these incredible stories of resilience of survivors and tragedies, and then that afternoon saying, all right, time to write some jokes. But it's just one of those things in the White House. You have to be able to do more than one job at once.
Did you do any reading of past presidential jokes to see, you know, what kind of jokes you can get away with? Or did you say, like, let's try this one and see if it works?
We did a little bit. I mean, I've looked back on other presidents who've been very funny, not just Democrats, by the way. Ronald Reagan, for example, very funny guy. But one of the things that I think always makes a politician funny is if they understand themselves and their own persona, and they're willing to play around with it a little bit. So President Obama, in addition to having great comic timing, he understood his public persona. He understood that he was on stage playing himself and could push the envelope a little bit, but always with that in mind. So he wasn't trying to be a comedian or an actor. He was trying to be himself, but a little bit funnier, edgier than you would normally see him.
Well, you know, when I think of the Reagans and the Obamas and presidents who were trying to be funny and were funny at different times, they often use self-deprecation when making jokes. I don't want this interview, and I'm going to make sure that this interview is not really any kind of criticism of Donald Trump, but can you imagine Trump making those kind of jokes, those self-deprecation jokes? I think you had a story in the book about the Al Smith dinner.
I did mention the Al Smith dinner when President Obama and Mitt Romney spoke there in 2012. And both of them, by the way, were funny, not just President Obama. Mitt Romney did a very good job as well. At the 2016 Al Smith dinner, Donald Trump was booed by the crowd, which I didn't think would be possible. You have to really cross all sorts of lines for that to happen. And to your question, I don't think he's ever made a self-deprecating joke. It does not seem to be something he's capable of.
So you were a campaign volunteer in 2008, and 8 years later, when you left, throughout that time, did your opinion of Obama change?
Well, what I wanted to write about was the way that my opinion changed, not just of President Obama, but what it means to be in public service, what it means to be in politics, because I think a lot of Washington books are on this continuum where you're either naive and idealistic or you're mature and disillusioned and cynical. And thinking about how I feel about politics right now, I'd like to think I am more mature than when I started, but I'm definitely not cynical about politics. And what I wanted to sort of chart was the way that I gradually came to feel that our politics is more broken than I thought, and even our most extraordinary leaders and the most extraordinary colleagues that I worked with, everybody is just a person. We're all trying to figure it out, and nobody is going to come save us. We have to do that work together. But at the same time, I don't find that disillusioning in a disappointing way. I find it hopeful because it means that together we can do big things, which I think is something that President Obama has always said. He said it on the 2008 campaign, and that's definitely something I came to believe was true. So in that sense, that's one attitude I have that definitely did not change.
What would you say was your highlight working for the president?
Well, there were so many. I mean, some of them were less serious than others. I mean, I remember, for example, I had this moment when I realized you could actually watch the movie Air Force One on board Air Force One. And that is not a historical accomplishment for the president, but man, that was such a, I just had this moment where I was like, this is so amazing. So some of that's what I write about in the book, but I also write about getting to be a tiny, tiny part of these historic moments. The night that the gay marriage decision from the Supreme Court came down in the morning, marriage equality became legal in all 50 states. The day before, the Affordable Care Act had just been upheld by the Supreme Court, yet another one of these challenges. And that day, I wasn't on the trip. I watched this speech, like everybody, on screen. President Obama gave that eulogy in Charleston where he sang Amazing Grace. And I talk about going to the White House with my then-girlfriend and now fiancé, and we stared up at this White House lit up like the colors of the rainbow, and there were couples surrounding us, I mean, of every description, and we were all lost in wonder because our country was better that night than it had been that morning. And that's a rare moment in politics, but those moments really do happen, especially when you put the right people in office and when people work together to get them there. And I wanted to write about that because I do think that this is a moment when it would be easy to be cynical about politics, even if you believe in the power of activism. But politics can lead to extraordinary things, not all the time, but some of the time. And I wanted to chronicle that as well as some of the more fun, less serious, watching, you know, you can watch Air Force One on Air Force One moments too.
You know, when I look at your book title and you talk about your hopey, changey years, it sounds familiar.
How's that hopey, changey stuff working out for you?
So my question is, did Sarah Palin get royalties on this?
I don't think Sarah Palin gets royalties. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say whatever royalties Sarah Palin is getting for whatever she's doing are far more lucrative than you would get on a memoir. But I think that the question that she asked, and, you know, ignore the way she asked it for a second, because I think in her telling it was a rhetorical question, it was kind of making fun of people like me. But the question is actually a legitimate, totally fair question. How did all of this work out? And the decision that I made, or it wasn't even a decision, it just happened to me, this path I went on where I believed in a candidate and a cause, was it worth it? Was it worth dropping all of the other things that people do in their 20s? I mean, you know, when my friends were kind of traveling the world and finding themselves, I was in government. And I had a great job in government, but it was not a sort of free spirit kind of decade for me. And I wanted to look back and think about those questions. What really happened? What did this experience mean to me and to so many of us who fell in love with Barack Obama in 2008 and then saw the real world intervene and had to come to terms, not to say that President Obama didn't do a good job, because, you know, spoiler alert, I think he did an outstanding job, but what did it feel like to be us? What was our part in that journey? Was it worth it to be involved? And I think the answer to that is also yes, but I wanted to look at why that is and how it felt along the way.
What advice would you give someone who was hired as a joke writer or even a speech writer for Donald Trump?
Quit.
The book is Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. I found myself smiling and laughing at some of your observations, but the book is actually less about Obama and more like just a fun, sometimes wild ride. David Litt, it was fun having you on the program, and good luck with your book.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
I started a joke, which started the whole world crying. But I didn't see that the joke was on me.
Last week, we invited you to respond to this question. What makes you a political junkie? We've already heard from many of you, but there's still more time for you to share your answers with us. Whether you love the political strategies or feel strongly about particular issues or appreciate public service or love the political history, or even if you're just a really big fan of this show, we want to hear what being a political junkie means to you. Leave us a voicemail with your answer at 316-KEN-9646. That's 316-536-9646. Or tweet us your answer using the hashtag #I'mApoliticalJunkie. We'll be sharing our favorite answers from you on social media and on a special conversation coming up on our 200th episode, which, can you believe it, is only 2 weeks away. But first, it's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last Emmy winner in the lead comedy or drama category who ran for public office? The answer, Roseanne Barr. She won in 1993 for lead comedy actress in Roseanne on ABC. In 2012, she was the presidential nominee of the Peace and Freedom Party, where she received nearly 62,000 votes nationwide. And the randomly selected winner is Al Turner of Columbus, Ohio. Al wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttlebutton puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. In a deeply divisive and tragic year like 1968, there was no shortage of major moments in the presidential election between Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey. But this was a big one.
As president, I would stop the bombing of the North as an acceptable risk for peace, because I believe it could lead to success in the negotiations and thereby shorten the war.
Vice President Humphrey, down in the polls and saddled with having to support the Vietnam War policy of President Lyndon Johnson, gave a nationally televised address from Salt Lake City where, for the first time, 49 years ago this week, he split with Johnson on the conduct of the war. He would stop the bombing of North Vietnam in an effort to bring peace.
In weighing that risk, and before taking action, I would place key importance on evidence, direct or indirect, by deed or word, of communist willingness to restore the demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam. Now, secondly, I would take the risk that the South Vietnamese would meet the responsibilities they say they are now ready to assume in their own self-defense. I would move, in other words, towards de-Americanization of the war.
It was a dramatic moment, one that threatened to change the predicted outcome of the election. Ted Van Dyke was a senior advisor to Humphrey. In fact, he wrote that Salt Lake City speech, and he joins us now to talk about it. Ted, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Well, thank you, Ken. Glad to be with you.
Well, you know, you think of all the things that happened in 1968 that will be ingrained in our memory forever, and there were plenty of them, but Humphrey's speech in Salt Lake was a big one.
Yes, it really, I was surprised by the outcome. Johnson and had deterred Humphrey twice earlier, weeks earlier, from issuing independent statements of his own, threatened him, said he would denounce him publicly. But finally, after the debacle of the convention, it was clear that we had to make a definitive statement independently for Humphrey. And Larry O'Brien and I conspired. We bought national television time and told Humphrey that, in fact, it was for the Vietnam speech, and so he had no option, really, but to deliver one. And what he did deliver September 30th was a clear break with Johnson, but it was a responsible speech. And I expected the morning after that it would have just a slight effect, but it was just electric. We did not receive any heckling for the remainder of the campaign from peace voters, only from Wallace voters on the right. It was just like somebody had pushed a button and everything had changed.
You know, you mentioned those hecklers. I mean, throughout, I guess, in the time since the convention and into September, it seems like almost anywhere where Humphrey campaigned, he was met by anti-war hecklers.
That's right. And it was very tough, and particularly tough on him because prior to assuming the vice presidency, he'd been the unchallenged leader of liberals nationally and in the Congress. And then he became trapped as Johnson's vice president in the war. And it was a very, very difficult period for him. I had urged him and helped get him nominated as vice president. But about a year into the Johnson presidency, it was clear that we'd made a terrible mistake. And I wished he'd just remained independent as a senator.
You were talking about what the reputation that Humphrey had prior to becoming vice president. I always think of this Tom Lehrer song.
Whatever became of Hubert? Has anyone heard a thing? Once he shone on his own, now he sits home alone and waits for the phone to ring. Once a fiery liberal spirit, ah, but now when he speaks, he must clear it. Second fiddle's a hard part, I know, when they don't even give you a bow. We must protest this treatment, Hubert, says each newspaper reader.
I mean, I love that song, and I thought of it often, but after September 30th, Humphrey became his own man.
He did, and those last weeks of the campaign were quite thrilling. And in fact, the Sunday before the election, the Harris poll had us winning by 3 points. But as you know, and as the recent PBS series emphasized, just a few days before the election, Nixon intervened with President Chu, arranged that Chu would not bring South Vietnamese to the conference table. The peace negotiations were off, and it was sabotaged, and the momentum we were gaining really stopped. And the question became, would we make this public, knowing about it? And it really was appropriate for Johnson to do so. He was the president. Nixon was flagrantly breaking the law in intervening in the diplomatic process. But after meeting with his advisors, Johnson decided not to do so. We did not break it publicly because, frankly, it would have been seen partly as partisan. Nixon would have denied it. There was no real point in it, but it was a shame, and so much has been different in the country because of the outcome of that election in 1968.
You know, I think of what you're saying now, I think it was certainly underreported at the time. Nobody knew of it, but you make very important points. There are two things. First of all, right before the election, and I guess it was a month, maybe about a month or so after Humphrey's speech, Johnson stopped the bombing of the North to bring the North Vietnamese to the peace table. So basically, what Nixon did, it was actually Anna Chenault, who was a Nixon person.
Yeah, she was his intermediary. He went to the South Vietnamese ambassador, who relayed messages back and forth. And frankly, I had been with Humphrey a year later when he met with Chu in Saigon, and it was a very unpleasant meeting where Humphrey told Chu that U.S. patience had run out, that we could not maintain the levels of military and economic cooperation as previously, and it was more than Johnson would have wanted him to say, but Chu became very hostile, and the meeting was very unpleasant. So a year later, it was no surprise to me that Chu was all ready to cooperate with Nixon, who said he'd give him better terms. So Humphrey, in fact, when we learned of it, and I told him of it, he dictated a statement which said that this was a Sunday in Los Angeles before the Tuesday election. He said if the South Vietnamese did not come to the conference table, he would, as president, withdraw all support for the government of Vietnam. He was furious, but I knew he was speaking emotionally, so I changed the statement to say, if the South Vietnamese did not come to the conference table, the United States would go there without them. And that was a departure in itself, but it was heartbreaking to have this kind of intervention. Another heartbreaking thing, I must say, was for Johnson as well as Humphrey, you know, the Great Society achievements of 1965 were truly historic. The Civil Rights Act passed the previous year, then Voting Rights Act, federal aid to education, Medicare, Medicaid, a war on poverty. Nothing has ever been done so historically in such a short time for domestic reform. All that was buried by Vietnam, which was a tragedy.
You know, when I think, I mean, there were so many tragedies that year. And one of them, I mean, I'm not comparing this to the assassinations, for example, of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy. But one of the tragedies, I thought, was watching a tormented Hubert Humphrey torn between his loyalty to Johnson and his desire for the war to come to an end.
Yeah, well, that had been going on for quite a long time. And one of the things that was interesting is when Johnson withdrew from the presidential race March 31, Humphrey delayed a long time in making a decision whether to run. In fact, he delayed so long that it was too late to enter any primaries against McCarthy and Kennedy. He'd have to go in conventions and caucus states. And one evening we over a drink, he said, well, I've got to make a decision. And he says, what do you think? I said, well, you've always wanted to be president. This is the best chance you'll ever have. He said, well, that's true. He said, but let me tell you, he says, I just have a gut feeling bad things are going to keep happening and I'll just be engulfed by them. In fact, he was. He did finally decide to run, but he was engulfed. Robert Kennedy was murdered. There was the terrible divisiveness in the streets, and then the Chicago Convention. And the poor man really endured everything, and then nearly won, as it turned out, only to lose at the last minute.
When I think of another thing that happened at the last minute, it was October 29th when Eugene McCarthy finally endorsed him. That was obviously very late in the campaign, a week to go.
Let me say on McCarthy's behalf, when Robert Kennedy had been killed
in June,
McCarthy came to see Humphrey and said he would withdraw from the race if Humphrey would only make some minor moves toward his position on the war. He said otherwise his supporters wouldn't move with him. And Humphrey told him, well, he didn't think he was able to do so. I talked with him about it afterward and urged him to make some modest. I said it'd be worth it to get McCarthy's early endorsement. But he said he thought Johnson would be so angry and intemperate as a result of it, it would destroy everything. So there was a chance, and I McCarthy was late. On the other hand, we had a telethon late in the campaign. McCarthy called and asked if he could be included on the telethon, and it was too late to get him out there, but I said we would make time for him to make a call, and he did make a call into the telethon nationally and heartily endorsed Humphrey. So I don't blame McCarthy that much. He's, for whatever, he had lots of motives, but he did, on a principled basis, oppose a war that needed opposition. And so I find it hard to be angry at McCarthy, just as I found it hard to be angry at Robert Kennedy. The Kennedys, by the way, were, although McCarthy was from Minnesota, the Kennedys were quite close to Humphrey. And one of the little unknown things in history is in 1960, when John Kennedy had already asked Lyndon Johnson to be his running mate, expecting that he would decline, Robert Kennedy came to see Humphrey and said a terrible mistake was being made. It looked as if Johnson was going to accept, but it was not too late. If Humphrey would accept, they would dump Johnson. And Humphrey said, no, he couldn't do it. So we talked about it afterward, and he said, you know, he said, I guess if I'd accepted, I'd be president now. I said, no, you wouldn't. I said, Nixon would be president, but because if Johnson had not carried Texas, JFK would never have been president.
Oh, gee. So many what-ifs, right?
Yeah. Robert Kennedy and Humphrey had talked, by the way, in 1968, and they had an understanding that whatever happened, Humphrey was headed for the nomination, but there was a long shot that Robert Kennedy might make it, and they agreed that both would support the other unreservedly. I mean, there's no problem about it. The real anger in 68 was between the McCarthy and Kennedy supporters. And 4 years later, I happened to be, I was policy director of the McGovern campaign. And one of the problems we had in the campaign is that animosity between the former McCarthy and Kennedy supporters was still quite high. I mean, they wouldn't talk to each other. They wouldn't cooperate with each other. And I found myself often being middleman between them so that our McGovern campaign could move forward.
Okay, now I understand your need to be and desire to be fair to McCarthy. My only point was that when McCarthy finally did endorse him, it was a full month after Humphrey made that Salt Lake City speech. So
that's right. But it was the speech itself that made the difference. And I don't know that McCarthy's late endorsement made that much difference. You know, the post-election data showed that we, in the end, got all the peace votes. But where we lost that election was with in a foretaste of what happened last year. Was in blue-collar voters in places like Ohio and New Jersey, where the traditional Democratic vote went either to George Wallace or to Nixon. That's where we lost the election. It was among what we later have called Reagan Democrats rather than among peace voters. We got the peace vote in the end, but it was not enough.
Right. It was exactly those Wallace voters. It took a lot of union households that always voted Democratic. You know, there were so many highlights of Humphrey's career. I think of the civil rights speech at the 48 convention.
Yeah, that changed the Democratic Party's posture forever.
Absolutely. That's when the Southern delegates walked out. But in his career, his entire career, starting as mayor of Minneapolis, how would you rate that Salt Lake City speech?
Well, I thought it was an important highlight. I thought the most important thing he ever did in his campaign was to be the principal sponsor of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I mean, that was an enormous achievement. Secondly, his 48 speech in Philadelphia, I heard that as a young kid out here in the state of Washington, heard it on the radio, and it inspired me. Little did I know I'd be his assistant a few years later. But that was a marvelous achievement. It changed, until that time, the Dixiecrats, Southern Committee chairman, had nearly dominated the Democratic Party. In fact, Harry Truman, as president, endorsed the majority plank, which gave concessions to the South. And Humphrey's minority plank, which was an unalloyed cry for civil rights, surprisingly swept the convention. And it did cause the walkout of the Dixiecrats, but it did change forever the Democratic Party and its posture towards civil rights. Thirdly, I think the Great Society achievements, which he had to share with Johnson, that was wonderful. And then finally, the Salt Lake City speech was important. But after all, we did lose the campaign but it was worthwhile to have done, and I'm proud to have had a part in it.
Ted Van Dyke was a senior advisor to Hubert Humphrey in 1968 as he was seeking the presidency. Ted, it was great having you on the show.
Ken, my pleasure.
It was 49 years ago this week, on September 30th, 1968, when Vice President Hubert Humphrey, in a speech in Salt Lake City, announced he would stop the bombing over North Vietnam if it would lead to peace. The speech was written by Ted Van Dyke, and it was a major break from the policies of President Johnson. 1 month later, LBJ halted the bombing. It almost, but not quite, resulted in Humphrey's election. Nixon's eventual margin of victory, 510,000 votes out of 73 million cast. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
It's all over.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.